This is the third day of this July 2013 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of Chinese Zen master Xu Yun of the 19th and 20th centuries when he lived. We left off yesterday reading his commentary on the what he calls the four prerequisites of Zen training, the different methods, or the four basic requirements a practitioner must meet. We went through the first, understanding and respecting the law of causation. The second was accepting the rules of discipline. And then the third is where we're on now, is faith. Having faith in our own true nature. We left off yesterday and where he poses the question, what prevents us from realizing this wisdom and attaining enlightenment? The answer is that we simply do not have faith in the Buddha's assurances that we are all equally endowed with this true nature. We prefer to remain in ignorance of this truth, to accept the false as genuine, and to dedicate our lives to satisfying all our foolish cravings. And now, he continues, ignorance of the truth is a disease. Now, as the Buddha taught, the Dharma is like a hospital that has many doors. We can open any one of them and enter into a place of cure. He's referring to the different methods of Buddhist practice. But we must have faith in our physicians and in the efficacy of the treatment. Physician, of course, means teacher. Whenever he wanted to illustrate the problems which doubt and lack of faith cause, the Buddha would relate the parable of the physician. He would ask, suppose you were wounded by a poisoned arrow and a friend brought a physician to help you. Would you say to your friend, no, 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 I'm not going to let this fellow touch me until I find out who shot me. I want to know the culprit's name, address, and so forth. And I want to know more about this arrow. Is the tip stone or iron or bone or horn? And what about the wooden shaft? Is it oak or elm or pine? What kind of sinew has been used to secure the tip to the shaft? Is it the sinew of an ox, a monkey, or a deer? And what kind of feathers are in the shaft? Are they from a heron or a hawk? And what about the poison that's been used? I want to know what kind it is. And who is this fellow anyway? Are you sure he's a qualified doctor? I think I have a right to know these things, don't you? So please answer my questions or I'll not let the man touch me. Well, said the Buddha, before you could get your questions answered to your satisfaction, you'd be dead. This parable is most often used, or what I've read of it being used, is in response to questions that are not practical. One of the doozies that I've heard most often is, where does this ego come from? Good question, but one that's not worth answering, even if one could. What does it matter where it comes from? We know that it is the root of ignorance. The cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. Let's work on the sorrow. Let's let's find out how to overcome suffering and pain and not concern ourselves with the provenance of the source of this pain. Xu Yun continues, "So, dear friends, when you find yourself suffering from the ills of the world, trust in the great physician." That's how the Buddha was sometimes called, the great physician. "He has cured millions of others. Which believer has ever perished in his care? Which believer has failed to be restored to eternal life and happiness by following his regimen? None. All have benefited. And so will you if you have faith in his methods." Faith is a kind of skill that you can develop. If, for example, you wish to make tofu, you begin by boiling and grinding the soybeans, and then you add a solution of gypsum powder or lemon juice to the boiled beans. You know that you can stand there, if you wish, and watch the curds form. You have faith in your method because it always works. Thus you gain the feeling of certainty. Of course, the first time that you made tofu, you may have lacked faith in the method. You might have been filled with doubt that gypsum or lemon water would cause the boiled beans to form curds. But once you succeeded and saw with your own eyes that the recipe was correct and that the procedure worked, you accepted without reservation the prescribed method. Your faith in the method was established. Roshi Kaplow always used to emphasize that in Zen, faith is based on experience. It comes out of experience. Strictly speaking, you don't even need to have faith in the story of the Buddha and his enlightenment. You just have to have enough faith in the practice to do it. And keep doing it. And if you can do the practice long enough, then from that, from the direct experience of Zazen, then the faith grows. In other religions, you're asked to have faith in God, or faith in that Christ died for our sins, or all kinds of things. Even in Tibetan Buddhism, according to some, you're supposed to have faith in rebirth. Well, you don't. In Zen, you don't have to believe a bit about rebirth. But you have to believe in the practice enough to do it and persevere at it long enough. It's a practice, not a belief system. And then the fourth of these prerequisites of his are to be resolute in our determination. And he says, "Let me warn you about the folly of jumping around from one method to another. Think of the Dharma as a mountain you must climb. There are many paths which lead to the summit. Choose one and stay with it. It will lead you there. But you'll never get to the top if you race around the mountain, trying one path and then rejecting it in favor of another that looks easier. You will circle the mountain many times, but you will never reach the summit. Stay with your chosen method. Be absolutely faithful to it." It's another problem that maybe Xu Yun encountered more than I have as a teacher. People don't seem to roam that much among different Buddhist paths. There's a saying I sometimes quote at introductory workshops. I think it's from India, where if you know that there is if there's water, ten feet down below the surface, you can dig all the holes you want that are 9 feet deep, and you won't reach it. What I think is a little more common, not much more common, in the West is flitting around from one teacher to another. And I believe it's the same danger. If you go from one teacher to another, then you don't really have... What the real danger is, you're not really facing yourself. It can be a way of avoiding the real work. Pema Chodron put it very nicely. She said, find a teacher and let him put you through your changes. So, he says, regardless of whether you choose the path of mantra or yantra or breath counting or koan or repeating the Buddha's name, stay with your method. If it doesn't deliver you today, try again tomorrow. Tell yourself that you will be so determined that if you have to continue your practice into the next life, you will do so in order to succeed. Old Master Wei Shan Ling used to say, stay with your chosen practice. Take as many reincarnations as you need to attain Buddhahood. Well, here in our lineage, and I think generally in Western Zen and Japanese Zen, it's a little different. Everyone starts with breath practice as a way of stabilizing one's concentration. And then some people will move on to work on a koan, and others will stay with the breath practice. But it's a very common progression to move from the breath practice to a koan. He goes on, I know it's easy to become discouraged when we think we're not making progress. We try and try, but when enlightenment doesn't come, we want to give up the struggle. Perseverance is itself an accomplishment. Let me repeat that sentence. I underlined it here for myself. Perseverance is itself an accomplishment. It's very important for people who are overly concerned about results. You are achieving something really quite remarkable in just persevering for years and years. I remember the first time I heard many, many years ago, pretty early in my practice, that when most people who begin Zen practice quit somewhere along the line. This was amazing to me, feeling as I did that Zen practice is the secret of the universe. Why would anyone quit when you found this secret? But it's true. And it's true in Japan, I've heard. It's true here. I don't mean that most people quit within a few years, but eventually life intrudes and the demands of life, family life, and other work seem to take most people away at some eventually. And then finally, he says, be steadfast and patient. You're not alone in your struggle. According to ancient wisdom, and then he offers this quote, we train for dreary eons for enlightenment that occurs in an instant. The next little chapter here is called Gaining Enlightenment. Zen has two famous masters named Hanshan, a 9th century recluse whose name means cold mountain, and a 16th century teacher whose name means silly mountain. For those of you who don't know this, the Chinese language, any character or series of characters can be understood in different ways. And so even though both of these guys were called Hanshan, they're two entirely, they live 700 years apart. And he goes on, Cold Mountain is Chan Buddhism's greatest poet. Silly Mountain was a pretty good poet too. He's probably Chan's second best poet. Cold Mountain appealed to nature to lead him to peace and understanding. In finding beauty in the natural world, he found beauty in himself. That's the way hermits operate. They look, they ponder, they convert loneliness into solitude. To wonder about that, the translation here. By the way, it says at the beginning that this record of Shuyun's teaching is based on is compiled from notes and recollections of Ji Din Shakya. Since Shuyun died in 1959, there would not likely have been any kind of recording of this. And always when we read from translations, which is mostly what we read, we read in Taisho, or from the original, or translations, of course, have to sometimes wonder about the translation. Here, about hermits, they convert loneliness into solitude. I don't know. Loneliness is... I don't know that how many hermits are lonely, and that's what takes them into their solitude. People sometimes ask about whether to do a solitary retreat. It really depends on the person, but more the timing, as well as the motivation behind the impulse to do a solitary retreat. Emerson said something insightful about solitude. He said, solitude is the safeguard of mediocrity, but to genius, it is a stern friend. So it can be an escape. An escape for people who don't get along all that well with others. Just want to be left alone. It can be, for some of us, it can be the easiest thing in the world to live alone. Because we don't rub up against people, or we don't have other people rubbing up against us, and it can give the illusion that one is in better mental health, better, more integrated than one thinks, than one really is. When you don't have others that you have to contend with, this is one of the great advantages of living with others, is you are continually being shown aspects of your personality and your character that can be a little painful. Zen historically has primarily been practiced in communities for the reasons just mentioned. I ran across a story about this matter of solitude. From the records of the Desert Fathers, Christian monks, and it's by an abbot, a Christian abbot by the name of Matois, I guess it's pronounced. So one of his monks asked him, "What shall I do? My tongue causes me trouble, and whenever I am among people, I cannot control it, and I condemn them in all their good deeds and contradict them. What, therefore, shall I do?" And then the abbot, the old man, answered him, "If you cannot control yourself, go away from people and live alone, for this is a weakness. Those who live together with others ought not to be square but round in order to turn toward all. Further," the old man said, "I live alone, not because of my virtue, but rather because of my weakness. You see, those who live among people are the strong ones." So he wasn't going to let this monk, who had a natural inclination to retire, get away from people, wasn't going to let him get away with thinking there was anything particularly noble in his case about living alone. His case at that time. And yet, if the time is right, and the impulse, the motivation, the intention is true, then it can be a great way of practicing for a while. I ran across some other words of wisdom on arguing that side. This is from an Inuit we used to call Eskimos from the 1920s. I'll give his name, although I don't think it would mean anything. Igjugarjuk. And this is what he said: "All true wisdom is only to be learned far from the dwellings of men, out in the great solitudes, and is only to be attained through suffering. Privation and suffering are the only things that can open the minds of men to those things which are hidden from others." When I do endorse someone doing a solitary retreat, I usually will say, well, just try it for a week or two, or not too long. Don't commit yourself to too long a stretch, because you should test it, see how it fits for you. Anyway, Shuyin says they convert loneliness into solitude. And then he goes on, Silly Mountain, that's the 16th century Zen teacher, transcended himself by working for others. He strove to help ordinary folks gain enlightenment. That's a little harder than surviving frost and hunger. There's that little whiff of humor. He strove to help ordinary folks gain enlightenment. That's a little harder than surviving frost and hunger. Of course, Xu Yun himself is someone who spent his life trying to help others come to awakening. And now he quotes the poet, Cold Mountain. High on the mountain's peak, infinity in all directions. The solitary moon looks down from its midnight loft, admires its reflection in the icy pond. Shivering, I serenade the moon. No chan in the verse, plenty in the melody. And then again, Xu Yun brings up how daunting it is, what the Hanshan, the teacher, Silly Mountain, what he said, he tried to put what couldn't be said into words everybody could understand. That's the dilemma facing a teacher. To try to express in words what cannot be encompassed in words. And he quotes Hanshan, the 16th century teacher, put a fish on land and he will remember the ocean until he dies. Put a bird in a cage, yet he will not forget the sky. Each remains homesick for his true home, the place where his nature has decreed that he should be. Human beings are born in the state of innocence. Their original nature is love and grace and purity. Yet they emigrate so casually without even a thought of their old home. Isn't this sadder than the fishes and the birds? He's making a very important point here, is that it is our nature to be loving, to be compassionate. It is our nature to be wise. This is our nature. But somewhere early in our life, we get alienated from this. We stray, we wander into self and other, us and them, and we find ourselves increasingly enmeshed in these notions, these concepts that leave us feeling alienated from who we really are. We know that human beings, because of this high, so-called higher mind, because of our discriminating mind, we are aware of ourselves the way that other creatures aren't, or sure don't seem to be. That is, we are afflicted by self-consciousness. But it cuts both ways. But because we have gone astray, because we have become estranged from our true nature through this self-consciousness, because we've separated ourselves from our innate endowment, enlightenment, because of that, only humans, they say, only humans have the possibility of experiencing the joy of reconciliation. Roshi Kapil used to say that each one of us took a vow eons and eons ago. It's the same vow that a peach stone takes to become a peach, or that an acorn takes to become an oak. It's the vow to realize who we are, to realize our true nature, to return, if you will, to use Xu Yun's example, to return to our true home. It may be that to be human, to be a human being, means that we carry this longing within us. Longing to be restored, returned to our home. There are so many ways to suppress this longing, to cover it up, to deny it. So those of us, and this would certainly be anyone in Sesshin, probably anyone listening to this, those of us who have realized this longing, that is, those of us in whom this longing has brought us here, can be considered the most fortunate people in the world. There's this old analogy in Buddhism of how rare it is to encounter the Dharma. And they say it's as rare as a sea turtle, a deep sea turtle, that arises to the surface of the ocean only once a year, and just happens that once when it pierces the surface of the water to do so in a floating ring, a wooden ring floating on the surface of the ocean. I mean, that's what the odds are, according to the old texts. The odds of us encountering this Dharma, this path to freedom, path to wholeness, is as rare as that deep sea turtle piercing the water in that wooden ring, just by chance. And then beyond that, even further, to want to come to Sesshin and want be able to arrange everything to come to Sesshin. This is doubly fortunate. What an opportunity this is. Xu Yun focuses on how sad it is for those who don't have even a thought of this, the least remembrance of the sense of oneness, non-separation. And he finishes, we would all like to reflect the moon of enlightenment. We would all like to get home to innocence. How do we accomplish this? We follow the Dharma. The Buddha saw the unenlightened life's ignorance as a diseased condition. His Four Noble Truths have a medical connotation. One, life in samsara is bitter and painful. Two, craving is the cause of this bitterness and pain. Three, there is a cure for this malady. Four, the cure is to follow the Eightfold Path. So this is the traditional articulation of the Four Noble Truths. And then he just comments a bit on this. First, we need to recognize that we are ill. Well, that's what we were just talking about. This is what is so rare, is recognizing that we're sick, in a way. Hakuin famously said, no matter how little sickness there may be in one's body, there is pain in his heart because there is delusion in his mind. This is a chronic sickness of all sentient beings. And yet most people, I think it's fair to say, most people don't understand this. They don't think in these terms. They only know this way of separation. Second, we need a diagnosis. Okay, the diagnosis is self and other, ego, division. That's probably a better way of putting it. Division, a mind divided, split, absent. Third, we need to be assured that what's wrong with us will respond to treatment. That's where the faith comes in again. And fourth, we require a therapeutic regimen. Samsara is the world seen through the ego. It is a troubled and sick world because of the ego's unceasing cravings. Here again, this points to the basic problem of being one of perception. We said this a couple days ago, we're reading from what he said, is not seeing things as they are. This is the problem. So samsara, of course, is not a place, but it's a way of misperceiving reality. Seeing it as a troubled and sick world. Trying to satisfy the demands of the ego is like trying to name the highest number. No matter how large a number we can think of, one more can always be added to it to make an even higher number. There is no way to attain the ultimate. Dear friends, isn't it true that no matter how much money a person has, he always thinks he needs a little more? That no matter how comfortable a person's home is, he always wants a place that's a little more palatial? That no matter how many admirers he has, he always needs to hear a little more applause? This goes right to the core of the Buddha's teaching and what he realized through his enlightenment. To quote someone else whom I forget, the sea hath, yeah, Shakespeare, when in doubt, Shakespeare, the sea hath bounds, but deep desire hath none. Shuyun, constant striving results in constant strife. So what are we to do? First, we must understand that the problems which the ego creates cannot be solved in samsara's world of ever-changing illusion. Why? Because the ego is itself an ever-changing fictional character that merely acts and reacts in response to life's fluctuating conditions, conditions which it can never quite comprehend. It's like trying to play football when the length of the field keeps changing, and instead of one ball in play, there are 20, and the players are either running on and off the field or sleeping on the grass. Nobody is really sure which game is being played, and everybody plays by different rules. Now, anyone who was expected to be both player and referee could never find pleasure in such a game. He'd find his life on the field to be an endless exercise in fear, confusion, frustration, and exhaustion. Here Xu Yun is emphasizing the chaotic nature of reality when misperceived. It doesn't seem to be any underlying order to it. We may for years actually think that we have a grasp of reality and the way things work, and then something happens that just turns us upside down, gets us questioning what it is. What is it? What is this? And then he outlines this, the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, a sort of a prescription of how to get well. And since our time is up, we'll wait until tomorrow to start on this Noble Eightfold Path. Stop now and recite the Four Vows.